Where did you go to school? And where
University
were you?
Of Illinois, uh-huh. Urbana.
And you studied theater?
Yes, I studied theater, rhetoric. I think for a while I was even in radio television.
Uh-huh. Thank God you got out of that.
Yes, it did interest me very much. But certain technical aspects of being, say, behind the cameras interest me. I'm interested in, you know, the sort of technical electronic matters. I don't know why, just as I'm interested in taking apart an engine, say, and putting it back together. I think any novelist likes to know how the world works, and that, so that sort of thing interests me.
Yeah, I think a novelist has to have an inquiring mind and want to know how things, how to tinker with things as well, because I would assume that writing a book is a process of putting things together and taking them apart and shuffling them around.
It certainly is, especially with this last book. Since I was tinkering with it for over 20 years, I came to know some of the people quite well. And that aspect of working, that tinkering and shifting portions here and there, made a lot of sense toward the end. In fact, I believe that I knew some of the people so well and got to know certain passages of the prose so well that I could more or less say toward the end, this doesn't go, this does go, and it, as it all began to fall into place. And then about 700 pages fell to the wayside as I went down, as I saw the center of the action and took out the extraneous matter and let the mainstream, as it were, stand.
Well, let's work up to a Bourne Brothers, and I'd like for the listeners of my broadcast to have some idea about you and your background. Why, Woody? I imagine as you went to school, your teachers and classmates had some difficulty with that name.
Yes, you know, the common response is, why Woody? And when I was a young man, of course, my answer was, because she was willing. So one has to get an answer for that sort of name. It's, I guess, from what I've been able to discover, a Slavic name. Though my ancestors came from Alsace-Lorraine, it seems to be a Slavic name. In fact, someone who is doing a, I believe it's a dictionary for the Bulgarian language, was quite familiar with the name. And he said, oh, that means X and X and so. It's a fairly common name there.
Where were you born?
I was born in Carrington, North Dakota, 1941, I believe.
I was so soon you've forgotten? Or are you trying to put that out of your mind?
It's so long ago, I can hardly remember. I barely remember the details of my birth, except it was pretty bright, and I think my mother was there, as I recall, and some nurses. And I was one of those children who, at the onset, it seemed, of the Second World War in rural America, began to be born in hospitals because the women of that generation had been born in farmhouses or at home, and they didn't want any more of that. So,
What did your family do in North Dakota?
My father was a high school administrator and taught also somewhat in high school, but largely his duties were administrating duties. Mm-hmm. And my mother raised the family. There were five children, so that kept her busy.
Well, with your father's educational background, I would assume that you grew up in a literary household.
Yes, I did. I would say that when I look back on my past, it was fortunate the way in which I grew up, because both of my parents read all the time. My mother also had a college degree. And I would say that many of her notes on the book she read, because she did keep a kind of journal of the book she read, are in a sense somewhat more percipient than my father's. He also kept kind of a journal of the books he read. Yet he was able to more or less get to the point always of what the books were about. I think some of his comments, particularly on some of the writers who were just appearing then, such as Hemingway, Steinbeck, other writers of that era, still have resonance today.
Were you encouraged as a child to write?
I'm not sure. I know that one thing has stuck with me. I think I can say I was never discouraged, though when I wished to begin writing as a possible career, possible profession, I remember my father saying, like every other parent has said, I'm sure, through the course of history, why don't you get a job and then write? But one thing that has always stuck in my mind is, it seems I was about maybe 14 or 15, and I was doing, as many young people do, digging through my father's things, trying to find a little bit about my own history. And I came across a book in which he had interleaved several of my letters that I'd written home over summers and other times. And it seemed to me, reading those over, I understood why he kept them, because they said something about my state of mind at that time, it seemed to me. And that he would preserve them encouraged me. I think I can say that that encouraged me to write.
That's in the book. There's a reference to that in the book, isn't there?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay.
There could have been some reference to that in an earlier draft, but I don't believe so. I think you might be thinking of I believe at a certain point in the novel, Charles writes a poem, and the father looks it over in the light of the storm about which the poem is written, one of those quick poems, struck by the lightning of inspiration.
Mm-hmm. You moved from South Dakota. Is it South or North?
North Dakota.
North Dakota. You moved from North Dakota to Illinois?
Yes.
This is also described in the book, in a way, leading up to the huge blast of that oil tanker in the book.
Yes, there are certain parallels and certain events in my life, that's for sure, that I've included in this book. I think to say that, well, then that's autobiographical and it means this poor fellow doesn't have an imagination is not quite the way to look at it. I think that the trend of American literature, certainly if you look at the writers from Hawthorne, Melville, down to Cather, Hemingway, and the rest, has pretty much been autobiographical. However, in this book, I wish to use a certain events that I could literally see pieces of or see details of, that is, pictorially in my mind, and set those down so that I kind of had set down as on a chessboard a certain amount of limited moves rather than letting, let's say, my imagination play free, which means a sort of often open-ended mishmash, it seems to me, in many of the imaginative novels. So within these many pictorial details set down, then I tried to advance the story of these two brothers. It takes place, actually, over about, I figured it takes place over about a two-hour period, as Charles recollects certain matters.
I'm sorry, a two-hour period?
Yes, the entire novel. The little flowerings or epiphanies of memory are happening in one room. That's stated on the second page. First he thinks it's the same room that it's been for over 25 years, but then he admits the room has changed a bit across the years. So if we look, or if I look at the manuscript carefully, which I believe I have, I believe he has finished his portion of the story. Definitely there's Jerome's portion, though I believe his narrative enters that. I believe he's finished what he's going to say about it when he speaks to his son or goes outside and drives a pair of tractors with his son, and then scoots his chair soundlessly backward, more or less moving into silence. But that particular piece in the book is positioned right near the center, and some of the things he has to say obviously occurred, all of it, in fact, occurred earlier. Nothing occurred after that point because we never see Charles older. So I feel it happens within a few hours, and I would say at the most two, because what I was trying to suggest is that if one sits down and recall specific detail. What usually happens, there's a detail here, and when those two are remembered, then several more fall into place so that suddenly there's a storm of memory. And I believe this happens to certain people at certain times. Anyway, it happens to me. And within an hour or so, you step out of that, say, term of memory, somewhat refreshed, usually because things have been reorganized in your mind.
And there's another parallel, if I understand you correctly. We hear about people facing sudden death, and their lives flash before them very rapidly. I don't know if this is true or not. Most of us don't have this experience, thank God, but people who have sometimes have said all of these things have moved so rapidly that they've seen almost every aspect of their lives within milliseconds.
Well, I think that those who have been near death or been at points at which they could be called dead, in fact, some were clinically called dead, have reported that experience. So it's not just that old thing, oh, I saw my life flash before me as this happened. I think something does happen to you almost perhaps cellularly, which is something I tried to indicate at one point in the book when Charles Keeps, as it were, hammering against death. I believe that my editor at the New Yorker, my former editor at the New Yorker, William Maxwell, saw this right away as he began reading this novel. He wrote me a note quickly, as he was only about 150 pages into it, and said, "My goodness, this young fellow is staring death in the face every page." And, yes, something of that then happens to Charles for whatever reasons, and it seems imminent then for him to get this these memories at least ordered.
Now, you've written Bourne Brothers in a non-chronological way. You have so many arresting scenes about childhood. As you wrote the book, did you write it in this form, or did you write bits and pieces and then find yourself integrating them so that it reached the level which has been created here?
It was pretty much chronological as I wrote it. That is, I wrote it in chronological order beginning at about, I believe it begins at about age 3 and moves through the brother's childhood, shared childhood, up to the point at which they're about 35 and 36. I did write all of that chronologically, but I knew also when I began the book many years ago that interposed there would have to be some of the present to give meaning to that. One of the few ways in which I agree with Freud, that as Nabokov called him, that Viennese witch doctor, is that the first 4 or 5 years of life are the most important. They leave their imprint. They are unerasable. When you're older, when you're more mature, you can not alter your memory, but you can bring logic and reason and so forth to bear upon your experiences, and you can say to yourself, indeed, well, that wasn't so bad. But when you're between 1 and 5, you're rather helpless. Events impinge upon you. You take them in with your senses wide open. And those first few years then can essentially never be altered. And it perhaps took this lengthy book to suggest something like that. I'm trying to suggest something like that, that what the brothers are at 5 is what they will be at 55. And perhaps they will grow more and more through their adulthood into that childhood. And I believe that's suggested by the ending of the book.
How does Bourne Brothers fit in chronologically with Beyond the Bedroom Wall?
Bourne Brothers is the book that Beyond the Bedroom Wall rose out of, so it was the, as it were, the genesis of that book. And I see it as the first book one should read, probably, if they're interested in reading the other book. I would want to read it first if I were sitting down to read both of the books, especially because now I see some of the different aspects of Beyond the Bedroom Wall, such as the language, the tone at times is not the sort of tone I would strive to reach now. I feel some of it has a nostalgic tinge, whereas in Bourne Brothers, where we see pages and pages of childhood, I don't believe there's a nostalgic tinge to that at all. It's a mere flowering, as I see it, or erupting of moments that are more or less factual.
Let's go back a little bit and talk about your chronology. When you moved to Illinois, where did you live there?
We lived in a small town called Manitou, which is approximately where Pettibone is located, though not quite on the same parallel, I believe, as I figured it out. Somewhere between Pekin and Havana, I found those conjunction of actual names interesting, the suggestion of east and west, we might say.
Then you went to high school there?
Yes, I went to high school there, and I went to college at the University of Illinois, Urbana.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What happened after college?
Immediately after school, I came to New York City, because while at college, I had met William Maxwell, who happened to be an old friend of one of my professors who taught me Shakespeare. And when I met William Maxwell there, we were just having coffee, and I was telling him how much I appreciated his talk, which happened to be on the autobiographical novelist during an arts festival at the University of Illinois. And he said, well, when you come to New York, come to see me. So that settled that I would go to New York. So immediately after school, I went to New York, and I did see him, and he asked to see some of the things I had written, and I showed him those, and they were the sort of thing that some young people were writing then, and I'm afraid quite a few are writing now, what would probably be called postmodernist work, using a fractured sensibility, distortions in time, little actual character, more theoretical application of fictional techniques of the William Gass sort. I was very much influenced by William Gass at this time, rather than dealing with, say, the actuality of what everyday people have to go through hour by hour of each day.
Yeah, the Gass approach is to take words and play with them, take images and play with them, and but not go into very deeply into the way people think and what they mean. It's fun to read his stuff, but it doesn't sustain itself very well, I don't think.
Yes, I think in the in Omen Setter's Luck, in the change of heart or whatever it is of the Reverend Jethro Ferber, we do get rather deep into the thinking of this particular man. Yet we're conscious always, I think, of Gass manipulating even his language too, so that it does have the certain feel and the texture that Gass wishes to achieve. In fact, he's written about this explicitly, how he wishes to achieve a certain linguistic effect, which has this or that effect on the reader or doesn't. I mean, that's
it. Well, I'm amazed by it, but I would rather not read it.
It is. He's one of the, I think he's one of the unsung great American poets. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, or as he would see it, he's chosen to write fiction, and he's chosen to write theory about that fiction.
Now, I remember that great debate that Gass had with John Gardner. Remember that? Gardner always said that Gass was wasting his time playing with these words when he should be writing about the human impulse.
Unfortunately, I missed that. I've heard
probably at London.
I've heard a lot of reports on it.
After reading Beyond the Bedroom Wall and What I'm Going to Do, I Think, then I read Eventide, and I was surprised by all of the New York references, because I pictured you as a Midwesterner down to the boots, and yet there was a real feeling for New York in many of these poems. So obviously New York plays a major role in Bourne Brothers. So this period of coming to New York must have been a very impressionable time for you.
Well, I was a young man, and New York was Mecca, and I came to Mecca New York was Mecca to me then, anyway. And I came to Mecca, and it had its effects, and it's made its lasting impression. I still love the city. I've lived here altogether now, I guess, for about 7 years, so I feel it relatively at home when I come back. I like to go to some of my old neighborhoods and scout around and see what's going on there.
What did you do while during this period of living in New York?
I wrote short stories that after I passed out of my postmodernist phase. In fact, I began writing something that originally was about my brother, and I decided to put aside the postmodernist theory for a while and just try to write about someone I knew. And I showed a piece of it to William Maxwell, and he felt now this was getting more onto the course of where he felt my material would lie in the future anyway. It is Bourne Brothers. That was the beginning of Bourne Brothers. While I was in the midst of it, I ran into some problems and was unable to keep on writing. I think that I wasn't ready to do the book. So at a certain point in it, I had reached a point of thinking or remembering, for some reason, my maternal grandmother. And I thought, well, I will just try to do a little sketch about her and see if it will fit into this, somehow into this book about what was then, not then called Bourne Brothers, but would later become parts of Bourne Brothers.
But how could you, Larry, possibly be ready for Bourne Brothers at that early age? I mean, Bourne Brothers is such a complex book that it probably represents the sum total of all of your experience over all of these years. And when you start, most writers start modestly, isn't that true?
I think youth is known most for its ambition, not its good sense. And I must say that I could picture clearly the book in the way it now appears. I could see quick flashing scenes, and with each sentence sort of turning on a different point within these small flashing scenes, ultimately working up to a conclusion which I couldn't see, and perhaps that's why I couldn't go on with the book, because usually I picture the ends of my books first and then right up to that ending. This ending I couldn't picture, and there are probably reasons why, if you read the book and see the ending, at the ending Charles goes headlong toward oblivion, something he describes or fears himself doing at the beginning when he is supposed by some of his neighborhood to be a junkie. I think he mentioned something like the downhill dive toward self-destruction, and Charles indeed becomes involved in that in some way, in some peculiar way, I think, because of his brother's effect on him, because of Jerome's effect on him, which perhaps, being so regular, stable, steady, yet with an underlying, I believe, current of, if not jealousy, then a wish for retribution for some of the things, say, perhaps Charles has done to him, or perhaps, again, a tinge of wishing to be like Charles. I think that's another problem of youth. We wish to be like others when it would be best if we could be ourselves.
Just go back to the chronology a bit. What happened when you left? Where did you go when you left New York?
After I'd lived here about 5 years, I believe it was, I was married, and my wife and I had our first child, and we did not want to raise the child here in the city. So when she was about a year old, we moved from the city and then literally began a kind of odyssey across the U.S. looking for a place that we could call home. And for about 7 or 8 years, I would say we lived in a dozen different places.
And you just drive around from place to place?
We would drive around, or we would have friends or family in an area and then would look around for a farmhouse to rent or Usually we were renting somewhere, generally at the edge of a city or out in the country, someplace where I could continue working.
How were you supporting yourself? Were you teaching?
No, I was writing. I was supporting myself then with writing. I was doing...
That's not the easiest thing to do, is it?
No, it's not. I was selling pieces of... At that point, I was selling pieces of Beyond the Bedroom Wall to the New Yorker, and that was sufficient to keep us in money to... Not to keep ahead of the creditors. That's not why we kept shifting address, but to keep up with the life we were leading then. Somewhere in the midst of that odyssey, we decided we wanted to live in the West. So then we took about another two-year odyssey out into the West, because my wife's from the Pacific Northwest. And strangely enough, we both felt that the only place where the true West was left to any extent at all in a way that isn't influenced by, say, Hollywood, or, on the other hand, by New York City, was in Western North Dakota. And that's how we... ended up moving back to the last place I thought I'd ever move back to, Western North Dakota.
Yes. Now, your first published novel was an ambitious effort. Tell me how this book came about.
I'd written a piece for the New Yorker about a young couple on the beach, along the beach in Lake Michigan, having an argument, and the magazine was very generous toward me at this point. I wrote the story, I think, in about two or three days, and they took it the next or something like that, and they published it very quickly. There was something in that scene that didn't seem to me to be resolved, and I wrote a longer short story about the same people that was eventually called The Boy, I believe, and the New Yorker also did that. And that still didn't resolve matters for me. And in the meanwhile, I wanted to get Beyond the Bedroom Wall done because I wanted to get back to Bourne Brothers. But I decided to take about... I remember I decided to give myself 3 months to draft then a novel, and I would use a longer short story, and then the right at the center of the book, I hope, would fall the scene between the couple. So I took off from New York City, where we were living then, and lived in a setting identical almost to the one in which the novel's now set, and drafted it there. I think it only took about 6 weeks, so I was grateful for that.
6 weeks to write this book?
Yes, to draft it, and then I worked on it for about a year. What I'm going to do, I think, yes.
It got great notices when it came out, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It seemed to, I'm not sure why, I think I have suspicions why. At that point in time, I was one of the disaffected, semi-disabled youth of the 60s, and I was wanting to examine some of the reasons for that disaffection of those who were and were not going to Vietnam, without particularly speaking about Vietnam. And that's really what I think the impetus behind what I'm going to do, I think, is that is what is hidden behind the narrative of that novel. A young man who is wondering, indeed, whether he should stand up for his, say, country, or stand up for his own values, or stand up for his family, and the way all of these pressures impinge upon him and his wife at this particular point in time had for me a lot to do with what was happening to my generation vis-a-vis the Vietnamese War.
Well, I had read these books so long ago, and I didn't know what happened to you. I mean, Beyond the Bedroom Wall must have been written, like, what, 10, 12 years ago?
It seems like it must have come out about 10, 12 years ago. Sometimes that seems to me like
there was Papa John.
Blink of the eye.
There was Papa John.
Yes, Papa John.
Which is kind of an aberration with regard to the other books. It's different. It's not like the other books.
Well, I think what I'm going to do, I think, is not like the other two large books, the companion books as I see them, Beyond the Bedroom Wall and Bourne Brothers. The difference with Papa John is that Papa John comes out of, in a sense, out of some of the fiction I was doing at the time I first met William Maxwell. In a sense, though that novel I began, and the New Yorker saw, I believe, a draft of the story for it, nearly 20 years ago now. It didn't work as a story, and it was because I didn't know, I believe, who the character was, so I kept it at a low simmer, as it were, in the back burner, and suddenly, in the midst of Born Brothers, I decided it was time to do this, Papa John, because I'd come to the conclusion that he was an old man, a very old man, and was an actor, and there were certain things I wanted to say about both age and acting.
Well, there's also a degree of strategy that has to be involved, too. You want to continue your readership. There are people who read your stuff because they like your stuff, and they stay with you, and I'm one of them. So you want your name out there, don't you? You don't want people to forget who you are, that you're still turning out material?
That's true. I think that as I look back over the years I've been writing, and it's been over 20 now, there was certainly a greater number of publications in the early part of that career, in that, maybe 12, 16 stories appeared in the New Yorker, say, over a period of 4 or 5 years, and now a story appears in the New Yorker maybe every 2 or 3 years. However, I must confess that, as in the midst of most of these books, I've interrupted them to do another, in the midst of those books, others have occurred. So I have many, many pages of other books accumulated, and soon now, I suspect, they'll be able to be coming out at a more regular rate.
And I think you mentioned that you had cut Born Brothers down rather stringently. You haven't thrown any of that stuff away.
I've thrown some of it away.
Really?
I just simply can't use it. I know that. Some of the scenes of that weren't directly bearing upon the brothers' lives, I can perhaps move into another book. I don't know, though. I doubt it, because they're so closely linked to so many things that I was up to in this particular book, that I don't think I can just take the pile of pages that I didn't use in this book and put them in a clothes dryer and let them mix up a little bit and pull them out and put them out together in another book. I wouldn't want to do something like that. But some of the... there was material that didn't bear so directly on the brothers' relationship that I still have around that someday I might use. I'm not sure. One never knows.
Well, Larry Whitewood, we're almost out of time. I did want to ask you one thing with regard to your teaching job. I assume you're head of the creative writing department at Binghamton, right?
I was director of the program for 3 years. I'm now off on leave.
Uh-huh. The creative process is so elusive, and as you've been talking to me for the past 45 minutes or so, you tried to explain how this comes about in terms of your characters and this sort of thing, but it's very difficult to pin down how one becomes a writer, a fiction writer. How do you explain this to your students? How do you tell them the things they have to do in order to write fiction? Or do you not bother?
Generally, the students who appear in writing classes want to write. And right there, you have an edge over many other instructors teaching many other courses. They want to write, and they generally are writing. And they come into a class with a certain amount of talent. Generally, someone or other has seen that they have some sort of gift for writing, or they feel that they do, and they'd like to exercise that gift. So then it's very simple to teach them techniques, to teach them ways in which to see their work more clearly, to teach them the simple matters of, say, structure, and some of the grosser, simple technical matters, such as how to write dialogue, because I find more and more young people, apparently they're not reading, because I occasionally get students who don't know that you put two quotes around a dialogue when people are talking, then a comma afterwards with he said or she said. Some of the younger students still aren't aware that this is the general form in which.
That may be because they haven't read enough.
I think that that is, yes, that's partly the problem. As it turns out, many have not read very much at all.
Are these students that you have, are they good?
Oh, yes, they're tremendous. There's a tremendous students at SUNY Binghamton. And I think there's been no class in which I haven't seen some growth in every young student. And then I also teach graduate students.
That was Gardner's college, wasn't it?
Yes, he was there for about 7 years.
I think he created that division, didn't he?
Well, actually, the creative writing program has been installed at SUNY Binghamton now for over 20 years. And when John Gardner came to the program, he stepped into a program that had been existing at that time for over 10 years, I believe, and made some revisions and revampings in it, some of which were loved, some of which weren't loved so much by people who were already there. And it's in the years since, I think it's been trying to steer a course more or less down the center of the road, permitting certain variations to take place within the program itself.
Well, that's a terrific rep.
Yes, there are about eight or nine really good writers there who are having a lot of success with their students, especially at the graduate level. Our students are publishing rather widely and gaining a little recognition of their own.
Well, my last question, Larry Y. Woody, what is on your literary horizon? What are your plans?
My literary horizon, within the year, I'll publish a new book. Ferris Strauss will be bringing it out.
It's last work for you.
Yes, yes. As I say, these books are now, they're going to be coming out every year or so, and people are going to say, now, what's the matter with him? He used to take 6 or 7 years, you know, a reasonable amount of time to do a novel. Now they're coming out every year. I don't think I'm going to read these.
Yes, they will. Larry Y. Woody, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.